Hello, and welcome to a special two-part Lord of the Rings series of Keynotes. The goal of this series is to examine Bear McCreary's music in the Rings of Power television show in comparison to Howard Shore's score for the Lord of the Rings movies. Due to licensing issues, none of Howard Shore's themes can be used in the TV show, and the extent to which there is continuity otherwise between the show and the Peter Jackson movies is unclear at this point. However, Bear McCreary has made it clear that he's not trying to reinvent the wheel. He says his motto was continuity, not quotation. He wants to be faithful to the palette that Shore had established, and Howard Shore even wrote the show's title music to re-solidify this relationship. Cataloging every piece of music in Howard Shore or Bear McCreary's scores would be too unwieldy a feat for this podcast, but others have done just that, at least for Howard Shore. A note up front that musicologist Doug Adams literally wrote the book on Howard Shore's score for The Lord of the Rings. His text is called The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films, and I highly recommend it. Much of the detail on Shore's music in this episode comes from Doug's book. At the time of this recording, only the sixth episode of The Rings of Power has aired, so it's possible that some of this examination will turn out incorrect or outdated, but I have a fair amount of confidence that most of it will remain accurate, at least relevant, and maybe I'll do a follow-up or two somewhere down the road. This podcast will have spoilers for every aired episode of The Rings of Power, as well as the entire Lord of the Rings film trilogy. It will also contain spoilers from The Silmarillion and the appendices of The Return of the King, both featuring material that influenced the show and the movies. Music is very important to J.R.R. Tolkien and his stories. The author was very fond of poetry and music, placing many songs and poems into the text itself. For Tolkien, even the act of developing languages and words has a kind of quality of musicianship. The Elvish languages, Quenya and Sindarin, are beautiful, elegant, and flowing, while the black speech of Mordor is intentionally ugly, full of consonants, and inherently percussive. Tolkien makes music cosmically foundational in the Silmarillion, the Elvish history of the world in which his stories take place. In the Aina Lindale, the first chapter of the Silmarillion, sort of equivalent to the Book of Genesis, Tolkien describes the very act of creation as music. In the text, the one god, Ilúvatar, bids his angelic beings, the Ainur, to sing a great harmonious song that brings the world into being. During the song, a selfish member of the Ainur named Melkor, the story's Lucifer figure, disregards the written music to sing his own melody, creating dissonance and conflict. This foreshadows the role that Melkor and his servants, such as Sauron, will play in the world. They'll create discord. Melkor was later renamed by the elves as Morgoth, and the war with him is recounted in the television series Prologue. In Tolkien's world, music is divine, and the first act of evil is to corrupt it. In reference to the creation story, the opening titles for the television show feature beautiful patterns formed by moving grains of sand and rock with sound waves. A serpentine layer of blackened earth slithers into the works and seems to disrupt things. Howard Shore developed his musical palette for the films by crafting styles and themes for the various races and cultures in Middle-earth. More often than not, a musical theme represents a people rather than a person. Bilbo and Frodo don't have their own themes. Instead, the Shire or Hobbit folk have one. Elrond doesn't have a theme. The elves of Imladris or Rivendell do, though Elrond is the prime representative. The same is true of Galadriel and the elves of Lothlorien. For The Rings of Power, Bear McCreary wanted to be true to the template set down by Howard Shore. The musical atmospheres for the elves, dwarves, humans, and the Dark Lord are stylistically in keeping with the movies. And sometimes a character and their people are represented by the same theme. This is true of King Durin III and the dwarves of Khazad-dûm, of Halbrand and the Southlanders, as well as Sauron and his servants. However, more so than Shore, MacCreary gives certain characters their own musical identities, especially for characters that go against the grain. The Harfoots have a theme, but Nori Brandyfoot has a separate one. The dwarves of Khazad-dûm have a theme, but Prince Durin has his own. Elendil and Isildur's leitmotif is different from Numenor's. Galadriel's theme seems to belong entirely to her. Elrond's theme somewhat acts as a stand-in for Lindon, the realm of the High King of the Elves, but it's more often used as part of his personal identity. But let's begin with the music that establishes the atmosphere and history of Middle-earth, or in the case of the Rings of Power, which sees realms off of the continent, the music of Arda, the entire world. Both the movies and the TV show begin with a prologue, narrated by Galadriel, that establishes the background for the story. The prologue for the first Lord of the Rings movie recounts the end of the War of the Last Alliance 3,000 years earlier, establishing the defeat of Sauron at the closing of the Second Age, and the failure to destroy the One Ring, presumably the same event which will be the finale of the television series. Set at the end of the First Age, the Rings of Power prologue is a telling of the War of the Jewels, in which many elves left their home in the realm of Valinor for Middle-earth, after Morgoth stole the Silmaril jewels and destroyed the two trees that lit the world. Following countless death and geographical devastation, this culminates in Morgoth's defeat, but Sauron's fate is left unknown. In the movies, Middle-earth's history and past is musically established by a few themes. The very first, heard in the Fellowship of the Ring, is that associated with Galadriel, the theme for Lothlórien, which is presented in the film as very ancient and very mysterious. The other themes that imbue the world with history are those associated with the One Ring, as the events of the Lord of the Rings movies occur in reaction to the ring's creation and its destruction. To speak of the past in that story is to speak of the history of the ring, or of the events caused by it, the corruptions and declines. The time-weary wisp of this history of the ring theme, as Doug Adams calls it, implies to us that the past forgotten will eventually reemerge. Later, when the Fellowship rolls down the great Anduin River and comes across the Gates of Argonath, twin colossal statues of the great kings of men in Middle-earth, ancestors of Aragorn, Howard Shore rises the orchestra up in choral grandeur, but then transitions to the theme for the Ring's ancient history. For the Third Age, the history of Middle-earth is tied to the history of the Ring, great glory and great tragedy. Save impersonal figures like Elrond, Galadriel, or Sauron, none of the story's main characters were around during the War of the Last Alliance. No hobbits, Aragorn, Gimli, not even Gandalf. And so none of their themes appear in the prologue to the first film. For Bear McCreary and for the show's narrative, the history of the world is less objective. The context for the past is musically associated with Galadriel's theme. The prologue's narrator, Galadriel, is a conflicted primary character in the show. Therefore, the context for the past heavily features a very subjective theme, her theme. Galadriel is a backwards-looking character with a profoundly personal connection to the tragedies of the First Age and to her childhood home of Valinor, where the prologue begins. Established on an eastern continent across the sea from Middle-earth, Valinor is the paradise-like kingdom of the High Elves, as well as the Valar, who are demigod figures that actually reside in that realm, not unlike the deities at Mount Olympus in Greek mythology. The weightless, heavenly theme for Valinor, which opens the entire series, is vocalized by a boys' choir, presumably in the language of High Elven Quenya. It has a kind of wistful divinity, but also a hint of paradise lost, especially when it shifts harmonically downward. The elves damaged their relationship with Valinor and the Valar when they left the realm in pursuit of Morgoth for the sake of revenge. Since the prologue is from Galadriel's point of view, we can see her nostalgia for the Blessed Realm is palpable, especially when her brother Finrod ascends to the crest of a hill and the city of Tirion is revealed in all of its splendor, visually and musically. Boys' choirs, or boys' soloists, feature prominently in Howard Shore's work on the movies. A boys' chorus laments the noble death of Boromir, and Shore's theme for the natural world, used for both the Ents and the Eagles, imbues nature with a kind of purity of strength. Conversely, a boys' choir is used as a deception in a specific persuasion theme for the ring. Questions of who might be seduced by the rings of power and why are central to the mysteries of the TV show. But for the movies, in addition to the theme established for the ring's ancient history, Shore develops a theme meant to evoke its power to seduce. Like the music for the natural world in the movies, the strength of purity exemplified by the great eagles and the Ents, and like the anthem for Valinor in the show, the theme for the ring's seduction is deceptively voiced by a boys' chorus. Its lyrics in High Elvish Quenya translate to a deception indeed. They suggest that the weapon's strength is for the needs of the valiant and for their victory. In other words, be a hero, use this ring for heroic deeds. The deceit of the theme, the apparent innocence of the chorus, only makes itself known by its melody, which is just a little too beguiling, a little too hypnotizing. Related to the ring's history and its seduction is the tragedy of Sméagol, the story's cautionary tale of what may become of someone who claims the ring. Beginning as a hobbit, the same kind of being as the story's purest heroes, Sméagol wasted away into the wretched golem by possessing the ring. Bilbo's long possession of it put him at risk of sharing Sméagol's fate, just as it did with Frodo. This sad, pitiful, and slippery theme is used in reference to Gollum and his fallen state, but it's also briefly stated at the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, when Gandalf witnesses Bilbo, who is reluctant to leave the ring behind, referring to it as his precious. The Rings of Power is not without its own cautionary music. Bear McCreary has very slyly introduced a motif with Celebrimbor, the accomplished elf smith of Eregion, whose grandfather Feanor also crafted magic jewels, the Silmarils. The creation and subsequent obsession over these glowing jewels caused most of the destruction of the First Age. The reason that I believe this music is not just Celebrimbor's theme is that Bear McCreary has stated that he's written a theme for the One Ring and for the Rings of Power themselves, and that we've heard it many times already this season. This motif is heard again as Celebrimbor and Elrond discuss Feanor and the Silmarils, and when Celebrimbor unfurls plans for his new forge. It also seems to persistently pop up each time the newly discovered Mithril is seen or discussed. And it's heard during the myth sequence that depicts the creation of Mithril from a Silmaril-infused tree as an elf battles a Balrog at the top of the Misty Mountains. I put this to Bear McCreary on Twitter, and he liked the tweet, so maybe. Here is the figure sung by a swelling choir over the recognizable Khazad-dûm rhythm. This Rings of Power or Seduction or Greed motif brings to mind the material John Williams wrote for the Ark of the Covenant in Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Ark of the Covenant, another sparkling, forbidden, ancient object, sought for its power, but to use it is to destroy oneself. A bit of speculation for sure, but hard to resist. I believe that this theme is, or will develop into, the theme for the Rings of Power and the One Ring. The Lord of the Rings is told mainly from the perspective of those that are not elves, and often from those that are astonished by them. Samwise and Gimli are particularly awestruck by elves, and Aragorn, with his part elven blood and faithful Numenorean heritage, deeply admires them. Elves are more often portrayed as other in the films, kept at a distance as the objects of icy beauty and unimpeachable wisdom. Howard Shore captures this by portraying their musical material as elusive and exotic. As mentioned, Galadriel and the Elves of Lothlorien are situated as the most ancient of elfkind. Musically, they're more mysterious than the Elves of Rivendell, and at first, potentially threatening. To develop this palette, Howard Shore drew from Eastern music and Gregorian chants. In perhaps the most drastic musical shift between the show and the movies, the music for Galadriel and the Rings of Power, while still brimming with beauty and high nobility, is not alien but very personal and very moving. Galadriel in the Second Age is not the immovable, statuesque figure we met in the movies, but a dynamic, emotionally burdened being full of inner turmoil. "I have a tempest in me," she says of herself. As with many of the musical themes from Shore and MacCreary, Galadriel's theme, leaping upward to a minor seventh as if to strive, is given numerous variations. At times it's tender and delicate. Other times filled with strength and resolve. Suggests peril and confusion. At one point during sword training, it's put in a spirited, swashbuckling pirate mode. When she makes cruel threats towards the captive Adar, a suggestion that she may be becoming the very monster that she's hunting, we're given a dark, twisted variation of her theme. And of course, very often, her theme is just given profound drive and purpose. In the films, Lady Galadriel's counterpart over the Misty Mountains is Elrond Half-Elven. For Frodo and his company, Elrond's Sanctuary of Rivendell is a welcome respite following a dangerous first leg of their journey. Shore's opulent and stately theme for Elrond and Rivendell situates them as wondrously benevolent. but the music's Eastern chromaticism and unpredictable progressions causes it to remain a foreign realm. In the films, Peter Jackson made the choice to portray Elrond with a diminished warmth and a hard face, likely to help give the character's counsel an increased sense of gravity and urgency. But a little of Tolkien's character is lost in the portrayal. In The Hobbit, Tolkien first described Elrond in part using the phrase, as kind as summer, and in The Fellowship of the Ring as having an ageless face, written with the memory of many things both glad and sorrowful. If one thing's for sure, it's that the upstart Elrond half-elven from the Rings of Power has less to be sorrowful about than the weary Lord of Rivendell that Bilbo and Frodo encounter. In the Rings of Power, we find Elrond taking orders, not giving them. He's an ambitious young diplomat in the Kingdom of Lindon, serving as a herald to Gil-galad, the High King of the Elves. His ambition will be his main inner conflict, but his skill in statecraft comes from, I think, a genuine affection for and kindness towards others. The show's Elrond does feel as kind as summer and does bear an ageless face. Though his theme also represents Lindon, Elrond is a primary character, and so we experience his kind-hearted theme from within rather than from a distance, unlike the Elrond and Rivendell theme from the movies. McCreary described it as wistful, innocent, and starry-eyed, but notes that passages shift between major and minor. He's a little lost. His music evokes a kind of carefree quality of a good person who hasn't been tested, but probably is about to be. At this point in the Rings of Power, the large part of Elrond's storyline concerns his relationship with Prince Durin of Khazad-dûm. In Tolkien, the relationship between the Elves of Eregion and the Dwarves of Khazad-dûm has a strong history. As we'll see in the first Lord of the Rings film, thousands of years later, the Fellowship will come upon the west gate of what was Khazad-dûm and its entrance, the Doors of Durin. There, moonlight illuminates an inlay of Ithildin, which is finely crafted mithril. It forms images and writing on the door. As a beautiful work of elf and dwarf collaboration, it depicts both the emblems of Durin and that of the House of Feanor, the tragic, vengeful figure who is responsible for the great elven migration of the show's prologue as they pursued Morgoth from Valinor to Middle-earth. As the moon lights the script and the images, the two trees, the seven-starred crown of Durin, the star of House Feanor, and the hammer and anvil, Howard Shore unfurls a small queue that honors the loyalty of elven allegiance. This is restated just once in the film, when the Elves of Lothlorien arrive at Helm's Deep as a gesture of their allegiance. The Sindarin chorus of this cue translates to, "The light of Feanor falls on two people. Such terrible beauty, such burning desire." In the show, Elrond has been sent to work with Feanor's grandson, Celebrimbor, who appears to have something of his ancestor's dangerous pride and arrogance in him. The text on the doors of Durin, which will presumably be constructed at some point during the show, credits the door's craftsmanship to both Celebrimbor and a dwarf named Narvi, who has not been introduced or cast in the show at this point, as far as I know. By the time the Fellowship enters the doors of Durin in the movie, Khazad-dûm is now a ruinous lost city, renamed Moria, which means the Black Pit. This occurred over 1,000 years before the events of the Lord of the Rings, during the reign of Durin the Sixth, that's two kings after the Prince Durin of the series, when a Balrog was awakened as the dwarves were mining for their precious metal, Mithril. Following much death and destruction on account of this Balrog called Durin's Bane, and as a result of orc and troll occupation, Moria became an empty, shadowy place. Thus, Howard Shore is not scoring Khazad-dûm, but the ghostly remains of Moria, what once was. The sequence of the Fellowship sneaking through the crumbling, steep, subterranean passages of Moria is accompanied by uneasy strings, low rumblings, and a distant chorus of dwarves, damned spirits from the chasms below bellowing in Khuzdul, language of the dwarves about the glory of Durin the Deathless and Khazad-dûm. Taken together, it's a tale of hubris as Durin was slain by the Balrog and the Dwarrodelph is now lost. However, Howard Shore gives us one great hint at the splendor that once was, as Gandalf illuminates one of the great halls, so that the Fellowship may look upon the vast achievement of the now fallen Khazad-dûm. Later, when the Fellowship is pursued by the Balrog called Durin's Bane, the urgency affords the composer the opportunity to give us a more present taste of dwarven music. The Khuzdul chanting returns with grunting and a frightening vigor. The lyrics from the Ghost Dwarven Choir translate to a tale of awakening the Balrog. Deeper into the earth, they say they delve, chasing the glint of Mithril. But a great shadow begins to move in the dark. The earth shakes, cracks, splits. Fire in the deep. The demon comes. Doug Adams fittingly calls Shore's dwarven material blocky and stout, pointing out that the melodies stack up in parallel fifths as if their harmonies were hewn to stone. These fifths are the stuff of power chords and modern metal music. As Elrond visits the dwarven city in The Rings of Power, Bear McCreary is afforded the chance to create music for a thriving Khazad-dûm approaching its apex. In keeping with his work on the other cultures, McCreary follows Shore's templates: the hearty, deep bass orchestrations, relentless heavy rhythms and percussion suggestive of hammering and mining, and a low male choir in the dwarf language of Kuzdul. I've not been able to find a translation, but it's clear they sing of the greatness of the city, especially as McCreary describes it as a rousing patriotic anthem. In addition to the main melody, the theme is given a unique driving rhythm. This is a technique that Bear McCreary uses fairly often in the Rings of Power score, allowing himself to use the rhythm by itself to efficiently suggest a character or to interweave multiple themes together. Durin III, King of Khazad-dûm, shares his theme with his realm. However, his son, Prince Durin IV, is given something a little more distinct. And like the Khazad-dûm theme, it's got a distinct rhythmic figure supporting it underneath. It's a jaunty melody, most often played on a viola or a cello, which immediately sketches out his personality for us. Despite the theme's attitude, McCreary finds ways to render it tenderly, important as a musical linkage between his theme and that of his friend Elrond, as a relationship is key to both characters. One of the ways the TV show nods to Tolkien's love of giving music making an active part in his stories is through the character of Prince Durin's wife, Disa. Over supper with Elrond and Durin, Disa speaks of the act of resonating, of singing to the stone. Inviting us to think of the mountain as a living thing, Disa compares it to a person, calling it a long and ever-changing story made of countless small parts. "Sing to it properly," she says. "Each of those parts will reflect your song back to you, telling you its story, showing you what might be hidden, where to mine, where to tunnel, and where to leave the mountain untouched." It's very likely Durin did not heed the mountain when he engaged a dangerous Mithril mining operation. And later we witness Disa enacting one of her resonations, singing a beautiful, powerful song to the stone. Not to find jewels, not to find ore, but as a plea to the rocks that they might release a group of dwarven miners who have been trapped during a cave-in. Her song is a Tolkienian communion with nature, standing in stark contrast to the transgression that resulted in the accident, mining where they ought not to. While the dwarves make their permanent dwellings in mountains, hobbits would make them in hills. Central to the Lord of the Rings are these quiet, peace-loving folk who unexpectedly find themselves wrapped up in adventures of legend. The hobbits, particularly those of the Shire, are generally homebodies who love simple comforts: gardening, food, ale, pipeweed, and pleasant company. For the hobbits, Bilbo, Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin, and their home, the Shire, Howard Shore developed a Celtic-influenced sound with rustic and folksy instrumentation. The music is good-hearted and innocent, and the main theme is frequently stated on a tin whistle. A fiddle, Celtic harp, hammered dulcimer, accordion, classical guitars, mandolin, and recorders are also in the Hobbit material, along with a baron and Irish drum for rhythm. As the story moves forward, the music of the Shire begins to represent both a deep longing to be back home safe and comfortable, and a reminder of what's at stake, what they're fighting for. While the hobbits at the time of the Lord of the Rings, the end of the Third Age, are homebodies, their ancestors in the Rings of Power are notably different in that they're not at all domesticated. On the contrary, they're a nomadic tribe that needs to frequently migrate as a means to survive. Their entire culture, even their spirituality, is based on this lifestyle. Are people on the move, ducking and hiding from potentially dangerous strangers they might encounter on their migration pattern. This sort of spirited antsiness is baked into the Harfoot theme, which, at a time signature of 11:08, refuses to comfortably settle. McCreary brings in Shore's Celtic influence in a deliberately less buttoned-up way, and develops a melody with small intervals, which he says represents their desire to stay hidden. Stated on bagpipes, the theme is accompanied by African balafons, a pitch percussion instrument, as well as claves and log drums, and familiar hobbit instruments like the baron, penny whistles, and tin whistles. Hobbits like Bilbo Baggins are deemed a bit strange by the community, as part of them hungers for adventure, to see the world, to sing songs and write poetry. Bilbo takes a special liking to his nephew Frodo because he sees something of himself in the boy. In the Rings of Power, Nori Brandyfoot is this figure within the Harfoot community. Dreaming of a wider world and the wonders it holds, she goes against the grain because, like the hobbits, the Harfoots are conformists and don't take well to those who deviate. Unlike her tribe, Nori's wistful theme showcases bigger intervals, perfect fifths. So if the small leaps of the Harfoot theme suggest playing it safe, Nori's melody is sticking its neck out a bit for the sake of adventure. Even more overtly Celtic, it's played on a penny whistle and is in a rolling 6/8, a time signature much at odds with the Harfoots. Both the movies and TV show recognize that the use of folk songs is an important way to give a depth of culture to the Hobbits and the Harfoots. Bilbo is a composer of songs and poetry, uncharacteristic for a hobbit, and in The Fellowship of the Ring, we hear both Bilbo and Gandalf singing parts of his song, "The Road Goes Ever On."
The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can.
Bilbo's 11th birthday has live Celtic-styled hobbit music. Merry and Pippin are fond of drinking songs.
You can drink your fancy ales, you can drink them by the flagon, but the only proof of the brave and true. Pippin! But the only proof of the brave and true.
And very memorably in Return of the King, Pippin sings a beautifully tragic a cappella song, a lament, as Faramir of Gondor is sent by his father to die.
Home is behind, the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread. Through shadow, to the edge of night, until the stars are all alight. Mist and shadow, cloud and shade.
In the Rings of Power, Nori's best friend Poppy sings a wandering song to keep spirits up as the Harfoots migrate across difficult and perilous terrain.
The sun is fast falling beneath trees of stone. The light in the tower, no longer my home. Past eyes of pale fire, black sand for my bed. I trade all I've known for the unknown.
The deeply Irish-inspired song, This Wandering Day, has lyrics that reference a riddle written by Bilbo about Aragorn. All that is gold does not glitter, not all those who wander are lost. Strider, one of the wandering folk, does not live on the road because he is lost, even if his people might be. Adjusted to nod at the character of Nori, who dreams of wonders in the world outside of her migration pattern, the lyrics in This Wandering Day are not just not all who wander are lost, but not all who wander or wonder are lost.
At last comes their answer, through cold and through frost, that not all who wander or wander are lost. No matter the sorrow, no matter the cost, that not all who wander
Next episode, we'll get to our world, the human realm, but Shore, of course, wrote a theme about the solidarity of the different races of Middle-earth. In response to overwhelming darkness, and having come into possession of Sauron's Master Ring, a company led by a wizard, consisting of elves, dwarves, hobbits, and men, courageously set off on a journey into the enemy's lap with his most powerful weapon. Shore's theme for the Fellowship is stated warmly and gently when the title of the film appears on screen. It develops in fragments as Frodo and Sam leave the Shire and their company expands to include Merry, Pippin, and Aragorn. finally comes together when the Fellowship of the Ring is established at the Council of Elrond. It then gets its first bold, gallant statement as the group ascends a hilltop, having set out on their journey. It loses strength after the Fellowship loses Gandalf and then fractures at the end of the first film. But it persists in a noble, yet slightly fallen state through Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli as they push on. Resolute courage in the face of dwindling hope is a Tolkien staple. That does it for part one of this two-part keynote series on The Lord of the Rings and the Rings of Power. Next episode, we'll move away from the more fantastical races and focus on the human cultures of the Second and Third Ages. Numenor, its successor kingdom of Gondor and their heroic figures, the more humble peoples of Middle-earth in the movies and the show, and complicated romances between elves and men. We'll discuss villains, the Dark Lord Sauron and his many evil servants. And finally, we'll examine and speculate about mysterious figures introduced in the show. All of our episodes are written, produced, and narrated by Nick Nylon. Before I go, I want to list off some sources that were essential to this episode. Most books listed can be found on Amazon.com, and all podcasts are on iTunes. The key reference work is musicologist Doug Adams' book, The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films. It features extensive interview material with Howard Shore, in-depth analyses of all of the music and thematic material, and a cue-by-cue breakdown of all three movies. The Fellowship of the Ring series from David W. Collins' podcast, The Soundtrack Show, which also references Adams' book, and culminates in an interview with him. Various interviews with Bear McCreary, especially his long YouTube conversation with In Deep Geek, and the composer's own ongoing blog series, The Lord of the Rings Appendices, inspired by the special features on the film trilogy's home video releases. The work and analysis done by Twitter user and YouTube channel Mano Verantes. You can find him on Twitter at amoverus, A-M-O-V-E-R-U-S, and on YouTube as Mano Verantes. Finally, the Tolkien professor, scholar Corey Olson's many lectures, podcasts, and video discussions on all things Tolkien. He's president of Sigmund University, and his prolific content can be found on Sigmund's YouTube channel and his Twitter account, at TolkienProf. As a piece of housekeeping, I'd like to apologize for the long delay on the second part of my Hitchcock music series. Due to some life changes and the amount of research and detail I was working with, I found myself at a bit of an impasse. This Lord of the Rings series is meant to try and kickstart the Keynotes project again. I can't say at this point for certain how consistent the releases will be, but I'm going to try and get them out more regularly. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Please subscribe, rate, review, or just leave a comment on iTunes or your respective podcast platform. You can email us at keynotespodcast@gmail.com. You can find Keynotes on Twitter at one word, at Keynotes Podcast, and you can find me on Twitter at Nick Nylon. Finally, to play us out, here's Valinor, a suite for the Blessed Realm, from the Rings of Power soundtrack by Bear McCreary. Thanks for listening.